The active history is pleased to present a recording of Gene Taillet's talk, We Get a Piece and We Get a Say, approaching Confederation from the perspective of the Métis Nation of the Northwest. The talk was delivered on April 22, 2017, and was the keynote address related to Aboriginal engagement and responses to Confederation during the Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto.
I have to admit I'm a little intimidated. I understand I'm in a room full of real historians. The commission to write the book for HarperCollins is to write a popular history, and I actually had to go and look that up, Google it, because I didn't quite know what that meant. And I have to tell you, I'm still not sure what it means. As far as I can figure out, it means don't use a lot of jargon and don't put too many footnotes in it. But I'm not really paying much attention to the don't put too many footnotes in. And part of that is because I gave a lecture yesterday on the Riel Opera, the Hearing Riel, just at Innes College. And I was talking about the fact that my grandfather and my great-grandfather wrote the first sort of popular history of the Métis Nation back almost exactly 100 years ago. So it's a little strange for me to be 100 years later walking back down that road again. But their book has been it's sort of taken almost like a comic book in the sense because while people don't necessarily disagree with the way they put the story, they didn't footnote any of it. And so historians always look at me and just go, I don't even know what to do with it because they can't track any of it. So I think I'm about to have a big dispute with my publisher because I want those footnotes in there so people can go back and see that even though I'm trying to tell it from the Métis perspective, what I'm trying to do is show that there really is documentary evidence to support what they are saying happened. So having said that, I am a Riel. My grandmother is Sarah Riel. My great-grandfather was Joseph Riel, and Joseph Riel was Louis's little brother. So, and my great-grandfather raised Louis's kids after Louis was hanged, and I myself played in the house that is Riel House now, which is a museum, when I was a little kid. So that just shows you how old I am. Having said that, part of what I wanted to talk about here is one of the things that strikes me in this discussion about how Manitoba, or what we would have called Red River originally, was brought into Confederation, is Riel and what was going on out there was so much more democratic than what MacDonald was doing and the actions that were being taken to take over Manitoba. And it really is striking. Some of the other things is when I started reading the other histories like Stanley and the many Mortons. There's too many Mortons rolling around in this, right? There's Arthur Morton and Bill Morton and Desmond Morton. And so once you start reading the Mortons and Stanley, and they all have their own sort of, oh, it's the clash of civilization. I think there's a lot of things you can say about what Riel was doing out there. And I don't pretend that everybody agrees with it or has the same perspective I'm talking about. But I think the one thing you cannot say is that they weren't civilized about it. There was incredible democratic debate and discussion, and they were very aware of running a democratic discussion here about how to enter Canada. So I don't know how you can come at this clash of the civilizations thing. I don't see it in the story. And then to follow up on the two people who were just talking earlier, which I found really interesting, my take on it is that it's all about the land. I think that's the thing that just glares out at me from the whole thing, is that it's all about the land. They want the land, they want the land, they want the land. So having said that, I'm going to tell you this story, which I think of as a transformation story, because the Métis Nation had its own laws, its own customs, its own everything out there, and then it gets sort of eaten up or gobbled up by Canada. So it is a transformation story, and it's not a pretty story, right? It's really not a nice story. So I start in 1868, and that's because Riel comes back to Red River in 1868. He's been sent away as a young boy to Quebec to the seminary. And the whole goal of that is they want him to become a priest, right? So he's a little 12-year-old boy. He gets scooped up by the church. And the church, I tend to agree, is a huge player in this, just a massive player. So I don't think we can ever talk about this as government stuff. It's not just, you can't just put the players are not just Great Britain and Canada, or even Great Britain, Canada, and the Métis Nation. It's Great Britain, Canada, the church is a big player, and you can't ignore the Orange Lodge, the Tory stormtroopers who are rolling around out there that MacDonald just uses as his bully boys whenever he wants to beat people up into submission to do whatever he wants them to do. So when Riel comes back to Red River in 1868, he doesn't start what's going on there. Riel's not the instigator of what's going on. He's just the young man, and he's young. He's 25, right? He comes back to Red River. I think he comes back heartbroken, right? Like this guy, first of all, he's sent out, all these people have invested in him becoming a priest, right? He's supposed to become a priest. People have paid for 12 years for him to go to school to become a priest. And basically what happens is he falls in love with a girl out there, right? You know, and yeah, it's not good for priests. Not supposed to be interested in sex or women. So he falls in love with this girl, and she falls in love with him, evidently. But her parents reject, they actually even have a promise to get married. Her parents reject him because he's Métis, right? So he's heartbroken, but also he then, I guess, has this big realization that, whoa, maybe I shouldn't be a priest if this is what's going on here. So he bails out of seminary school just before graduation, right? I mean, literally like 6 months before he's about to graduate, he bails from school. And then on top of that, his father dies, right? So I think he's got a lot of stuff going on. By the time he comes back to Red River, my own sense is that he feels a bit like a failure. The difference is that he gets back to Red River, and what he feels like, he's a failure because he's not a priest, right? And they don't care. They got lots of priests. They don't need another priest, right? What they've got, though, is a really well-educated young man, one of their own, who comes back, and he can write, and he's articulate, and he knows how government works. I won't go too much into it, but he's really interesting detour that Riel took on his way back to Red River, which plays out in all this, right? So Papineau plays this in a huge role in this whole story, right? So the patriots who fled Quebec and went down into the United States, when Riel left Montreal and the seminary, he went and stayed with them for 2 years, right? Then, and also his father was a Papineau patriot, right? So he's coming back, and his father is the one who brought Papineau's stuff to OS. I don't know how many of you know this, but the Métis Nation rolled around the prairies for 40 years flying the Patriot flag, right? You know, so Papineau's a huge influence going on out there. I never see this in the Morton stories or anything like that, but it's true. So, and it was Louis Riel Sr., who was the patriot who comes with these ideas of responsible government and all of this kind of concept. So when his son comes back, he's spent time with his father's buddies in the United States. He comes out west, and so he arrives in Red River. And so what you have is a lot of people who are really unhappy about what they, and they talk about this, that they feel they're being, and I'm quoting them, sold like cattle. Right, that Great Britain, the Hudson Bay Company has sold their charter to Great Britain, or is about to, depending on what time we're talking about, and then Great Britain's going to sell it to Canada, or give it over to Canada, or transfer it to Canada, and then Canada's going to make them a colony of a colony. And they feel like they're chattel being sold. And what is going on in Red River at that time is that people are complaining that nobody's got a plan. And that's where Riel comes in, and that's his brilliance, is that he's the one who has some ideas about what they can do about it. So that's quite interesting. That's the good part of it. The bad part is Riel's completely naive about the mechanisms that MacDonald and his pals have at play. So what we see in the takeover, basically, is all these mechanisms of state containment and state power, outside agitators, propaganda, spies, the latest in technology and weapons, demoralizing techniques, and quite frankly, brute force, right? So it's kind of a matrix of power, standard colonial matrix of power, which is what MacDonald implements to attain his own colony, which is exactly what he wanted, right? Let me just give you some stats about Red River at the time. So in 1870, you've got 12,000 people there. Basically, 85% of them are what we would call Métis today. I'm not even going to get into all the distinctions about half-breeds and whether they're English-speaking or Protestant. That's a whole other lecture, and I'm not going to go there. So 15% of them were what the... Les Anglais is the term that term for basically their broad grouping of British people, right? So they didn't distinguish whether you're Scot or English or something like that. They called them les Anglais, right? So, and then they would distinguish the Americans and the Quebecers, whom they would have called Canadiens, as opposed to les Anglais, right? And les Anglais could be the people from Ontario, or it could be people from Great Britain. And then, of course, there's the First Nations people. And, of course, there's Americans. There's an amazing guy named Enos Stutzman running around there. He's a legless lawyer. I'm serious. I can't even imagine. And apparently he was a great horseman. So a legless lawyer in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s running around. And he's a brilliant constitutional lawyer. Absolutely brilliant. So, you know, when I'm seeing some of this, there's sometimes I see things written and I look at that and I go, that's not Riel's writing, that's Stutzman, right? So, and he's advising Riel. So he keeps coming up from Pembina up to, he's an American, right? But he's always in and out of Red River. So you've got these characters running around that are amazing. So the other big important thing is we always talk about how Aboriginal people are a very young population, even in Canada today. Back then, take a look at those stats, right? You know, of 12,000 people, 8,000 are under the age of 21, right? So you've got, like, this is a lot of young people running around the country right there. And the division of the adults is pretty even French-English, slightly more French than English, but it's not a lot more. The division of the children is way different because the French Métis are having way more kids than the Anglophone, what they would have called the half-breeds back then. So the other thing is to remember when I'm going to start talking about the pests is that Red River is a valley, okay? It's a big valley. So, and it used to be part of a big lake, right? It used to be Lake Agassiz. So Red River still, I grew up right at the banks of the Fort, and before they built what we used to call Duff's Ditch, but there's a big diversion ditch now that goes around Winnipeg and stops Winnipeg from flooding now. But when I was a kid, I spent many years sandbagging. You know, my Easter Sunday memories are of sandbagging. So what we call Red River back then is not strictly the river, right? It's the Red River Valley. And what the Métis would call Red River wasn't just the Red River, it's the Assiniboine as well. They thought of it as one river, right? So the Red River to them was all that big area there. Now, it of course would not have looked like that because you can see the farmed out sections and everything like that on this right now. So the reason I wanted to talk about this is because in 1865 and 1866, they had torrential downpour rains that just virtually didn't stop. So what happened was there was a lot of flooding, and Winnipeg is already known as Mosquito Central, right? What you had, see, those are mosquito clouds. Now, if you read the Métis accounts of being out on the buffalo hunt, and mosquitoes are a big thing, right? So clouds like that come. And I've read accounts where what happens, and you can hear them. So I invite you to imagine. We all know what one mosquito sounds like. Imagine what that horde sounds like. So evidently, if you're out on the buffalo hunt and you got, like, you know, 1,000 people out there. So you're out on the buffalo hunt. It's noisy. Okay, there's one thing we can say about Métis people. We're not the silent savages. Okay, they were loud. So you got those Red River carts going, right? And it's wood on wood, right? Because you couldn't have grease on the axles because it would all just get clogged up with dirt right away. So, and they screech. And everything you read about is this horrific sound. So imagine 500 of them in like three long trails going across the prairie with this screeching, screeching, screeching sound. Add to that about 1,000 dogs barking, yapping, running around. Then add to that the fact that the people would be yakking and talking on top of that noise so they could be heard, right? Yakking away. So when these come, what happens is the horses and the dogs can hear it way before humans can, and they start to freak out. The horses just literally start to run. The dogs are going crazy. But the Métis, of course, have figured out what that is, even though they can't see it. So what you do is you grab your, whatever you've got, buffalo hides, whatever, hunker down and cover yourself, right? And it could be 95 above out on the prairie, hot sun, and you got a buffalo robe sitting over you. I invite you to imagine how pleasant that is. But if they land, so what this picture on the bottom is the depth of mosquitoes that you get, right? And you can see it on the car there, how many mosquitoes you got. Well, what happens is when they land on your horse is probably dead by the end of this, right? Because you can have them 9 deep on your horse or your dog, right? So what happened after 1865 and 66 when the waters came, the Red River Valley was pretty much flooded, and it's a lowland, so everything else is swampy. It's just a perfect thing to generate mosquitoes. So you get these mosquitoes landing here. That's pest number one. So then you get pest number two, and that is the plague of locusts arrives in the fall, and grasshoppers come by the thousands and basically millions, and they eat everything, totally just destroy the colony. And so when what happens is when the grasshoppers arrive in the fall, they chew everything, but they lay eggs. So then in the spring, when all the new stuff starts to grow again, the lovely grasshoppers reappear and eat it all out again. So what happened here was by the time you get to the spring of 1868, everything's gone and got famine because of there's too much water and the grasshoppers have eaten everything. So what happens then is the buffalo keep a wide berth because there's nothing to eat. Right, so they stay further way out of range, and apparently the fisheries failed. Even the rabbits and pheasants disappeared. Everything. So there's famine going on, and so what I say is that you know famine was a nasty stalker, but it wasn't the only one. Right, so we've got two pests. Third one's there too, and the third one are what I call the jackals, and that's basically what the Orangemen from Ontario or what the people in Ontario like to call the Canada First Party. These days it has an eerie echo of Donald Trump, but there are a lot of eerie echoes in this story of what's going on right now. But there was a really ugly mood in Red River. First of all, everybody's hungry and starving, and then you've got these jackals running around, the mostly John Christian Schultz, headed up by him. He's a nice fraud artist. He arrived in Red River himself in 65 and 2 weeks later decided to proclaim himself as a doctor. He was a wonderful scam artist. He and a very small group of people were sowing a lot of racism, bigotry, nasty things in Red River, and religious conflicts because, they were all anti-Catholic and anti-French, and in particularly, I guess the part of the problem that I see with Métis people is that unlike First Nations, where there's a lot of prejudice against First Nations for sure, Métis people, we break the key social taboo, which is the mixing of the races, right? There's even a lovely, ugly word for it called miscegenation, right? You know, it's a taboo. And what the Métis would have known as the Canadas, that, and it was not a term of endearment, believe me. That was the big, at the root of it, was that they hated the Métis even more. They sort of thought the Indians were children and needed looking after, but the Métis, you're just like a violation of nature. You need to be eradicated. And they used those words. They're out to exterminate the Métis off the face of the planet, and they literally say that. So what you see then is there's a bad mood in the colony. Everybody's unhappy. Everybody's hungry. And the Canadas are there making a lot of trouble. So what it is the Canadas are what the Métis see as what it's going to be like to join Canada. These guys are the only vision they have of what is coming at them, and they can see it coming, right? You know, it's 1867, they know that this is going to happen, and it really doesn't look good, right? So Canada hasn't acquired the Northwest yet, but they're lusting after it, right? There's real, they want the land. There's no question about it. So this provides a perfect example. So I think somebody mentioned MacDougall. He's one of my favorite people in this story. I love the nicknames for him. They called him Wandering Willie, right? And that's because he was always looking for political advantage, so he wandered around taking different positions according to what would get him furthest into his, you know, where he wanted to get. So Wandering Willie was the Minister of Public Works in 68. So he sees that the famine gives him a foothold to get into Red River in advance. So what MacDougall does as the Public Works Minister, and by the way, he has absolutely no legal authority to go into Red River at this time. Canada doesn't own Red River. They have nothing. It hasn't transferred yet to Canada. They have no ability to do there. So he decides that he's going to create a public works project, like a relief party, a road work party. So they start building what is called the Dawson Road. And the idea is to build a road from Thunder Bay to Fort Garry or Red River in Manitoba. Now, it's not a bad idea to build a road, but what his idea was that it would provide relief for the settlers. And unfortunately, though it was just a scam from day one, there were virtually no settlers working on the relief project. It didn't provide any relief for any of the people there. In fact, most of the people working on it were military guys sent out by MacDougall on purpose. This is the first of the military hidden troops that are being sent into Red River, because as far as I can see, there's a plan from day one to send, to take over Red River by a military option. But so this is the first group that come in, are the Dawson Road workers. Canada provides $30,000 for this, but you know, as far as I can see, they might as well have thrown it in the Red River for all it provided no relief. And in fact, the people who were the road workers, it cost them more than a month's salary to buy a pound of flour. Right, and they had to buy it from one of the stores that Schultz, one of the big Canada's operators, so it was a big pork barrel scheme going on so that the money gets filtered to Schultz and his buddies. And meanwhile, these guys are trying to claim land. They're staking out land. And the Métis are already getting upset. So Augustin Nolan out at Oak Point basically sends a letter to the chief guy on the road work and says, if you want to keep your head on your shoulders, don't come back here again. And I, you know, I, having read a lot about Augustin Nolan, I don't think I'd want to mess with him. You know, he was a pretty serious dude, and he had a lot of boys. So I think that one of the things that we see is that MacDougall was using the roadwork project as an excuse to get his people in there to, I think of it sort of as inspect the goods. I think we've got to really understand that Canada's about to take over Red River and the whole Northwest and the whole Rupert's Land, and they have no idea what they're taking over. We keep showing these lovely maps that have it all surveyed out and everything like this. It is not what they knew. They had no idea out there. There have been two groups, Hind, who was, I don't know, basically, as far as I can't figure out what he actually was good at except travel writing, but he was sent out as a geologist, and he produced a terrible geological survey out of it that nobody can do anything with. And there's another group sent out to do some mapping, but they only did this very tiny little area in southern, and the rest of it is all just faked, right? They have no idea what they're walking into here. They don't know how big it is. They don't know anything about it except what they know oral stories from the voyageurs, right? That's really all they know. So they're going in there, and I think this was MacDougall trying to go, okay, let's inspect the goods. We're going to get this sooner or later, so, you know, let's not worry about. So it reminds me of my little niece who wants to open up her Christmas present before Christmas Day, you know, and she's sitting there holding the box and wants to open it, right? And that's exactly where MacDougall's got. He's got this big present he likes, and he wants to get in there and take a look at it. So the road didn't provide any relief for anybody, and it also gave everybody in Red River a pretty good idea of how what these guys were like. But I guess my point is that the big issue here was that nobody was dealing with the fact that there were people here. There were real people here who were being transferred to. So it didn't doesn't seem to have occurred to anybody, not to the governors of the Hudson Bay Company, not to the government of Great Britain, and certainly not to Canada, to talk to anybody in Red River. There is absolutely no communication going on to the people in Red River about what's going to happen. And so that's big part of the problem, is that they didn't think it was worth the effort to talk to these people. So I think they thought they were, a complete non-entity out there. Now, I think to be fair, Canada and Great Britain certainly knew there were Aboriginal people there. There's no question about it. They knew they were there. They did not know exactly who they were. They didn't know where they were exactly. And they certainly didn't know how many there were, right? So they got this vague idea, okay, well, there's some Blackfoot out there. And, well, okay, I think there's some bunch of Cree out there, you know. But that's it. That's really all they know. They have the odd survey, and the surveys are terribly done, right? Because some guy's doing them, and it's basically who comes to the post or something. Like, they're terrible surveys. So a complete under-evaluation of how many people are actually out there, and certainly where they are. And that's because some of them, you can't even get into them. Like, nobody got into Blackfoot territory. Right? Certainly no white guys got into Blackfoot territory. They'll let you in on the edge, but that was it. They didn't actually let you right into their turf. So I think the other thing is that we have a history in this country of forgetting our history. We just don't remember it. And Canada and Great Britain had completely forgotten about what we used to call the Massacre of Seven Oaks. English people have sort of toned down their language lately. The new revised monument from the 200-year anniversary this June is now called the Battle of Seven Oaks instead of the Massacre. But the Métis have always called it the Victory of the Frog Plain, right? Just gives you a totally different concept. And my brother, who's a biologist, always is intrigued by that because he says, look, oak trees, so Battle of Seven Oaks and the Frog Plain, oak trees and frogs do not cohabitate. Frogs are in the swamps or wetlands. No oak trees where frogs are, right? So they forgot about the fact that the Métis had been in existence for a long time, that there was a people there. They completely ignored it, and they succumbed to the propaganda, the Schultz and the Canadas, right? And I would say we're still doing that. So this, I'm sorry, I forgot to put it in my PowerPoint so you could read it. This came out this Monday in the Globe and Mail. This Monday. I don't know if you read that moment in time thing when they open the first page and you get the moment in time. And it says, stirrings of dissent in Red River Colony. April 17th, 1867. It would be 2 years before the Red River Rebellion broke out in what is now Manitoba. But in the spring of 1867, there were already stirrings of dissent in the colony. The Globe, in a reprint of an article from the Nor'Western newspaper, noted that citizens were considering taking over the local government from the Hudson's Bay Company, which was still in charge and heartily disliked. Indeed, the report said that, quote, a fur trading monopoly can have any interest in common with a farming, grazing, and mining community is felt to be impossible. The political condition of the country is simply this. 10,000 people are ruled by the committee of a fur trading company. They are allowed no voice whatever in the government, unquote. Then the Globe goes back to comment, the situation boiled over in 1869 when the Métis under Louis Riel, pictured above at center, declared a provisional government to negotiate Manitoba's entry into Confederation. This is so weird to come out in the Globe right now. I mean, the first thing that should jump out to anybody who knows anything about the geography of Canada is Winnipeg, a mining community? Really? Who? What? Like, there's like 1,000 feet of topsoil in Manitoba, in Winnipeg. There's no mine. This is not on the Canadian Shield, right? You know, there's no mining going on. That's the first thing that drives me crazy. But the second thing is the Nor'Wester. This is like quoting from Breitbart News, man, and taking your alt facts. That's exactly what the Nor'Wester was. It was the Breitbart. Well, the Globe was kind of the Breitbart as well. But the Nor'Wester was just the rag that John Schultz produced, right? The head of the Canadas, the Orange Lodge guy, right? These guys are the ones who are producing this. And there were literally 15 of them. So he's saying, you know, how everybody's unhappy? Only them. you know, the other 10,000 people are fine because they've already beaten the Hudson Bay Company into representation on the Council of Assiniboia. The only one who's not on it is Schultz because nobody wants him there, right? He can't even get elected in his own little community, right? Because they all know he's a bully boy, a liar, and a fraud artist, right? So nobody's doing anything with him. But the Globe and Mail this week publishes this with absolutely as if it's verbatim truth from back then, with no context, no, and completely unaware of what it is doing. I have to say, wow, has anything changed? I usually talk about the Northwest because the Métis are from the Northwest, and I always say to my students, you know, you get a term like that, you should ask people, north of what, west of what, right? It's like the Middle East, middle of what, east of what, you know? So the Northwest was always north and west of Montreal. Originally, that's what it was. Then it sort of expanded to north and west of the Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto corridor. But basically, this has always thought it's the center of the universe, right? And we're all still north and west of that, right? So Canada knew that there were people out there, right? They absolutely knew, but they didn't know exactly what they were doing. And they certainly gave no credence at all to the idea that the Métis were a people, a sort of a corporate entity, and if you want to call it that, a collective, a group of people. That didn't enter their brains. They knew there were what they would have called half-breeds, but the idea that there was a collective out there that they might have to deal with, that was not something that they gave any credence to. And I think one has to ask about that, because, you know, the idea that of what they were asking for, you know, there's discontent certainly going on out there. They know about it. Hind, who's the guy who I talked about, who's the bad geologist but the good travel writer, I mean, he warned them that there were problems coming. Archbishop Taché actually traveled to Ottawa specifically to tell them, hey, you guys, you got a problem here. You should at least talk to these people. And Governor McTavish from the Hudson Bay Company made a special trip as well out to Ottawa to say to Cartier and McDonald specifically, hey, pay attention, you guys, you got a problem here. You should do something about it. And Cartier and McDonald just, we got this all under control. We know all about it. Don't worry about it. We got it. Whoa. How about talk about being wrong? So this is all going on. Nobody's talking to Red River. And I think I have a picture. That's actually a painting from the first Council of Assiniboia from 1813. But I also, so this is one of the statements that I think Stutzman, the legless lawyer out there, wrote, right? Because it doesn't read to me like Louis Riel, and there's actually probably nobody else who could write this, right? There's only the two of them who would write this kind of thing. I'm just going to give you a second to catch it, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. But you see, it's basically this idea that they want to talk, they've got rights to be consulted on it. So I think the other thing that's going on is you've got a vacuum. So when no one talks to anybody in Red River, what happens is you get a vacuum there. And I think when you have a vacuum in knowledge, it gets filled with rumor. And that's exactly what happened in Red River. And this is from Alexander Begg, who kept a journal at the time, a daily journal going on. So he's an interesting character just because he's not Métis, but he's living in Red River and he's writing down every day. Actually, what he's writing down, you can almost say it's a journal of rumors, because unless he's actually there in the right spot at the right time, he's just repeating what he's hearing going on in the colony. We hear this, we hear that, some people say this, some people say that, nobody knows what's going on. So what's the difference between what the Métis are thinking, what I would call the French Catholic Métis versus the English half-breeds, and this is the vast majority of the people there, is that the French Métis, as far as I can see, are men of action. And we're not talking about women here. There's absolutely no record of any women anywhere near any of these discussions. But the French Métis, those guys are men of action. These guys are buffalo hunters. They're warriors. They're men of action. If they get an idea and they think that something needs to be done, they just get up and do it. And they certainly have discussions about it and debates and everything, but they're pretty quick. They have these big discussions. Everybody says what they think. They make a decision. They always vote on it. They make a vote, and then they go and do it. The English did it differently. They tended to have much more faith in the institutional idea of Great Britain sort of institutions. So the one thing everybody in Red River agreed on, everybody agreed, was they didn't like the way this was happening. They didn't like not being consulted by Canada and not having a say in the terms on which Red River would enter into Confederation. But beyond that, nobody agreed on anything. So the English half-breeds are kind of, well, let them all in, Canada in, and we'll work it out after. And the Métis are saying, no, I can't do that. That's way too late. You can't do that. Then we won't be able to make any terms. We need to make terms before they come into Canada. So what happens then is the Métis, as I said, they're men of action. They started to take action. So when they found guys from the survey crew or from the roadworking crew, by the way, I think I skipped over that part, that MacDougall, he sent in first the roadworks and then he sent in surveyors, right? And all of those guys were military guys, and they were all trying to stake their own land claims, right? They were all busily staking. So the Métis had had enough once they saw the surveyors staking claims. So they basically booted them off the lands, and they filled in any wells they found, and they got obliterated any signs of the staking. And they basically then started having their own meetings, and they laid out a turf of land that they were saying, this is ours. Now, I'm sorry, I'm not a map maker. This is me roughly trying with bad tools in PowerPoint to draw a rough area, because this is what we have from Father Richot's bad language. He says, it was not a small territory. So they expressly set out an area. They say it ran from Turtle Mountain to Poplar Point. This is in Richot's notes. They're almost impossible to read the description of this territory. But anyway, this is what they're saying. And they went in that area, and anywhere they found people who'd staked out claims, they got rid of them all, right? So that's kind of interesting area there. So then what's happening is the Métis start calling meetings. And this is one of the Métis leaders, William Dees, who tries first to harness the Métis. So what you've got is a lot of people talking, they're having all these meetings, and these are the classic old leaders of their day, right? So Dees and Hallett and Ganfon, these are the guys who are the leaders at the time, and they are incredibly unsuccessful in gathering the forces here. But Dees is the first one to try and do it. So on July 29th, 1869, he calls a big meeting at the courthouse, and everybody goes, right, to this meeting, and he's got a plan, right? So his plan is this. He wants the $300,000 that Canada's going to pay the Hudson Bay Company, right? He wants the $300,000 to come to the residents of Red River, and he says that should be paid to buy out their rights, right, their Métis rights. That's what he's saying. Now, he doesn't get too deeply into how on earth this could possibly happen and where he thinks he's going to get the $300,000. Like, basically what he says then is we should go to take over the Hudson Bay Company's strongbox in Fort Garry and take the money, as if the $300,000 is sitting in the strongbox in Fort Garry. I mean, Fort Garry, I mean, it's a store, right? That's really what it is, a store, right? And they'll have money, no question about it, but they won't have that much money. There's no, I think Canada had to borrow it to get £300,000 together. So basically what he's going to do is rob the store, right? So this shocked everybody because he's actually a member of the Council of Assiniboia. So he's saying, let's overthrow this government that I'm a member of. And this, as you might tell, went down like a lead balloon. The Métis people didn't like it at all. And they basically walked out. They were considering signing a petition to object to the Métis wrote so many petitions. Actually, there's a Métis treaty project out there right now that's got a big shirt grant to work on Métis treaties, and one of the things they're doing is collecting all the petitions that the Métis ever wrote, and as far as I understand, there's over 250 of them. So these guys wrote petitions. It was what they believed was the right way to democratically try and get your thoughts across. Anyway, Dees went down with that, and with that, he never became a leader in this whole situation. Right at that point, then you have John Bruce steps up. He's the one who objects in the meeting to Dees. And if you any of you know, the very first National Métis Committee that's constituted, Bruce is the president and Louis Riel's the secretary of it, right? But Bruce is only ever really a nominal president. It's really run by Louis from day one, right? So they voted D D's out. But what D's did, though, is he woke everybody up. There's no question about it. He woke up the people to the fact that they had to do something. If they wanted to stop this, they had to do something. So meanwhile, we have MacDougall, Wandering Willie, on his way. And he arrives with a big entourage at the Pembina border. And he's got, I think it's funny, actually. He comes with two thrones. Okay, one is the throne that apparently, according to the accounts, that and you've got to remember, the Métis were the freighters, right? So they're the ones who are carrying all this stuff. So I actually tend to trust their descriptions when they say this thing's happening or that thing's being brought in. I actually think they probably knew what was going on. So they say he had two thrones, and one of them was this incredibly ornate throne, but the other one was a throne of the kind that had not been seen in Manitoba to that date, and that was a toilet. And so their Métis bard, Pierre Falcon, wrote a scathing satirical song about the man with two thrones. So I'm not going to go too much into what MacDougall did. Suffice it to say that on December 1st, the day he thought the transfer was going to happen, he went over the border in the middle of the night, made a proclamation of his authority to the stars and the wind, and I guess a couple of horses, and then beetled it back over the border. And after that, he was, you know, before that, he was Wandering Willie, and after that, he was Silly Wandering Willie. So at this point, you have also the surveyors are happening, right? So the surveys come. I'm not going to get into the detail of it, but except to say that this is what obviously set everything on fire, right? This is what Riel stopped. So what happened is the surveyors, and again, I still maintain they are actually a thinly disguised military force. They all had titles like major and colonel, and they were all packing in their suitcases, and they bragged about this. It's in the written documents that they had military uniforms with them, right? So they're doing their survey. They go across Andre Nault's hay privilege. He starts yelling at them, saying, get off my land, but he doesn't speak English, and they don't speak French. So he goes away and gets Louis Riel. Louis comes back with 18 guys, and I want to emphasize they are unarmed when they do this. They're not going with rifles here. They just go, and basically Jean-Baptiste Richotte stands on the surveyor chain, and then they all stand on the chain, and basically, okay, you're done. You're not surveying anymore. So there were no guns going on at that time. The guns, and I think the reason that the Métis pick up their arms becomes quite evident after a while, quite shortly after that. I'm just trying to skip a few pages here. Right, so I think what we've got here, just so you have an idea of what MacDonald's theory about what's going on is. So his correspondence is clear from day one. This is what he's on about. He wants to keep the Métis, to shut them up, keep them quiet until the people that I think were talked about here, all the 10 sons who want the land, can come and take over the land, right? So his whole goal is a delay tactic, shut them up, keep them quiet, try and find some way of appeasing them until these other people come and can take over the situation. So what happens then is that you have the rifles. And that's the other issue that I don't find that other the Mortons and Stanley talk about. So what happens is that about 100 Spencer carbines and 250 Peabody muskets. Now, as I understand it, I am not a military expert, this is high-tech equipment of the day, right? These are the best rifles you can get, right? And they're sent out there with 8,000 to 10,000 rounds of ammunition, okay? And these are sent out. MacDougall requests them on September 15th, 1869, and Cabinet approves it on September 22nd, and the rifles are shipped out, and they left Kingston on October 1st. Now, Louis Riel doesn't stand on the surveyor's chain until October 11th. So nothing's happened in Red River yet, but they're shipping out 100 Spencer carbines, 250 Peabody muskets, and 8,000 to 10,000 rounds of ammunition. So what I'm told by the military experts is that that's enough ammunition and rifles to arm a regiment, right? Then the question is this, who are they arming, right? Because there is no regiment. There's no police. There's nobody. There's nobody there to arm for this, right? So the rifles arrive in St. Paul, and as I said, the Métis, they're the freighters, and of course they know what's come into St. Paul, and the minute they find out, it goes through Red River like wildfire. The Métis have what we call a moccasin telegraph, right? It goes really quickly. The news spreads very, very fast, and so everybody in Red River knew that all these rifles are here. So I think the question for us is, why did Cabinet approve rifles to come out there enough to arm a regiment? Like, this isn't just MacDougall and his party with a few guns and stuff like that, which I think everybody in the West would expect, right? You know, but enough to arm a regiment when you don't have a regiment, you don't have any force at all. I think it's a big question of what did they think they were doing. And as far as I can see, all I can see is that MacDonald and Cabinet intended to take over Red River by force. That's really what this is all about. So then we have to ask whether there is a military force there. And that's when you start looking at the road working crew. And that's when you start looking at the surveyors who have titles like major and colonel. And you start looking at the fact that they have military uniforms. And you start looking at all that. And that's what I think. Now, whether that's correct or not, what I think is that that's what the Métis thought. I think they saw, they heard, these guys were bragging about their uniforms. They were bragging about their titles. They insisted on being addressed by their titles, major and colonel, and they knew about the shipment of arms. And I think that that's when the Métis picked up their arms, because remember what I said, on October 11th, they had not picked up arms when they protested against the survey. It's after that that they picked up arms, and I think it's after they found out about the rifles, and they thought that Canada now was not coming to negotiate or to talk. This was not a relationship. I think Louis Riel and the Métis up until then had thought they could negotiate this, right? There was something to talk about here. And after this, I think that's when they said, okay, this is not a talking matter anymore. This is a military option, an operation. And that's when they picked up their arms, and that's when they put the barricade up, and that's when they started having their meetings, and they did meet. So in October, they met in St. Norbert, and they voted to codify their laws of the prairie, and they did that. And then 2 weeks later, they had a big assembly where something like 1,000 Métis were there in St. Norbert, and they voted to adopt the laws, their laws of the prairie, as the laws they were going to live under, and they voted to create their provisional government. So this is what happened. I think it's completely in response to the military threat that they perceived coming at them. Now, was that what MacDonald was, I don't know, was he just hedging his bets? I don't know, would you hedge your bets in this situation with enough military stuff to arm a regiment? I don't know. So anyway, I think that the Métis had hoped that when they joined Canada, they would come in as allies, and basically that died, that dream died when this happened here. And I think even on a crass level, you know, you sort of look at this, you say, MacDonald, what did he think he was doing? You know, you're going to take over this place, there's, you know, 10,000 people there or 12,000 people there. Why wouldn't you even just send an envoy who said hi first, you know, hello, nice to see you? But they didn't. They sent guns. And I think that that's the thing that changed everything. I think I'm getting a nod here, but I am at the end pretty much. So so I think that what I wanted to say here essentially was that the meetings they held, and then you get into their conventions and the elections and the meetings day after day after day, debating back and forth how to join Canada. It's an astonishing act of democracy in the face of what I would say is Canada's complete lack of same. And I think that this could have all gone down very differently. And I think the only thing you can say is that MacDonald, they'd just gone through the Confederation debates. They knew, they had trouble with Nova Scotia, right? They knew that little provinces and small groups of people were going to have ideas about what they were. The only reason that I can see that they didn't think they had to talk to the people in the Northwest is because they were Aboriginal people. And they didn't think that they were worthy of discussion. So I think that this whole story, the story of the land, the story of the basically racism, and the story of the failure of the Canadian state to use any kind of democratic methods to come to, or principled ideas or statesmanship, was all completely absent in this story. And I think we live with that failure to this day, because everything that happened after that comes because of that failure. So, thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Jean Taillé's talk, We Get a Piece and We Get a Say, approaching Confederation from the perspective of the Métis Nation of the Northwest. The talk was the keynote relating to Aboriginal engagement and responses to Confederation during the other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca and be sure to subscribe to the History Chats podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.